That in the interest of keeping the time, we should get started with this this conversation, this workshop that Peter Kent has put together for us. As I was just sitting here, I was thinking, you know, what are my qualifications to even address a group as illustrious as this one? But frankly, I don't know. I don't know. I came to the United States 30 years ago, and then I realized that I was a Hispanic. You know, when you migrate to the U.S., the immigration process makes you think that you have to belong to a particular compartment. And that was mine, but before I came here, I wasn't too aware of being different from the rest. I'm from the Dominican Republic. But in retrospect, this ingenuous, it's naive to think that we don't have diversity-related issues in places like Latin America. And I was just talking to Peter that I have a slide, which I recently presented at a couple of meetings, of the migrations within Latin America, for example. And you have the Haitians migrating to the Dominican Republic to cut the sugar cane, and the Guatemalans going to Costa Rica, and you know, the Venezuelans going to Colombia, or the other way around. And some of those populations are indigenous. They're Indians, American Indians, if you will, and they have their own values, their own cultures, and they are in contrast with the areas where they migrate to. And in lecturing about disparities in healthcare, I've become more aware of how the populations that are not part of the establishment, be it Filipinos in Hawaii or Haitians in the Dominican Republic or Hispanics in the United States, there's always a disparity, a discrepancy in the health services that they receive. So that's one aspect of it. As a medical school or as a school of dentistry or school of public health, we are acutely concerned about disparities in healthcare in the United States, because unless the population as a whole is healthy, then the very foundations of the country begin to erode. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is how we, as co-workers, feel valued and feel included in the context of the organizations that we work in. And I'm somewhat pleased, not entirely, with the results that we obtained from our recent survey, which was done in collaboration with the American Association of Medical Colleges and 15 other medical schools, or medical centers, I should say, because they included other schools other than the School of Medicine. And we targeted several thousand people, and a good thousand people responded to the survey. We had a reasonable response, and the overwhelming majority reported that here at this medical campus, they feel valued, they feel equitably compensated for the work they do, and they feel that there's an atmosphere of fairness and so on and so forth. They either agreed or strongly agreed with all those positive comments. But there were areas of concern. Too many details to discuss them in this meeting, but we have issues that we can continue to work on and improve. I can tell you that in the last year and a few months that I have been the Associate Dean for Diversity and Multicultural Affairs, my main thrust has been to dispel the notion that diversity is primarily concerned with issues related to race or ethnicity. That had been the major concern of the Office of, well, in fact, it was called the Office of Minority Affairs a few years back, and then the name was changed to Office of Diversity and Multicultural Affairs, and some institutions refer to themselves as Office of Inclusion and other permutations of the concept that by tapping on our differences, we can be better than we would be otherwise. But there, you know, you to the best of my knowledge, you can't go to Harvard or to BU and get a master's degree on diversity or anything like that. Let me know if there is one, because I'd be interested, or a PhD, or there are workshops and courses, but It's something that you either have to have an interest, or by virtue of your own experiences, you develop it. You develop a knack for. And somehow, after Jonathan Woodson left, I ended up in this position. I want to thank Peter for putting together this activity. It's going to be interactive to a large extent, and we have a short slide presentation, which includes the title, Creating an Inclusive Work Environment, and the learning objectives. This is a CME-accredited activity. Are to define the benefits of a diverse work environment and also the detriments, because there are some drawbacks regarding diversity, and to identify strategies to effect organizational change and to recognize and neutralize unconscious bias, which is really a really important concept which affects all of us. I will read the mission of the medical school, which I think should apply for all of the other areas, not just the medical school. But we are dedicated to the educational, intellectual, professional, and personal development of a diverse group of exceptional students, trainees, and faculty who are deeply committed to the study and the practice of medicine, to biomedical research, and to the health of the public. That's the ideal, right? That we are all deeply committed. And we, as a community, place a great value on excellence, integrity, service, social justice, collegiality, equality of opportunity, and interdisciplinary collaboration. I think that embodied in the mission is not just that we are interested in diversity for diversity's sake, but that through diversity, we may reach some of the excellence that we strive for. And from this point on, I'm going to let my colleague, Dr. Khan, continue explaining some of the slides, and then we're going to open it up for an interactive lunch. Thank you.
I'm Peter Khan. I'm the Director of Faculty Development and Diversity in the Department of Medicine. I thought we would take some time to go around and introduce ourselves, because I think we come from different backgrounds, from different parts of the campus, and probably have different goals in attending this workshop. So why don't you tell us who you are, what you represent, and what you hope to achieve by the end of this hour. So can I start with Dan?
Sure. I'm Dan Oates. I'm a geriatrician. I work in the geriatric home care program. I'm a BU alum. I'm also the faculty advisor for MedGlow, which is a gay LGBT medical student organization. And I'm here to now in my new role to see what I can do to more facilitate diversity within our institution.
I'm Jenny Siegel. I'm a new junior faculty member in the section of general internal medicine. And I'm here just because this is a topic that's important to me, and I wanted to meet other people who are interested in it.
I'm Jane Leibschutz. I'm the chair of the Faculty Development Diversity Committee, which is sponsoring this. I'm also the Boston Medical Center Wellness Director, and I feel like diversity issues are an important piece to play in thinking about wellness.
Anna, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, Anna Bowler from Neurology. I'm Edie Oblowski. I'm staff at the School of Public Health, and I'm here because I work with a lot of students, and I'm just interested in making them feel as comfortable as possible.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Friedlow. I'm the Director of Organizational Effectiveness and Human Resources at Boston Medical Center, and we just actually rolled out a program called Managing a Diverse Workforce, and I'm looking to, you know, just for other ideas that we can add to the program.
I'm Mary Schneller. I work with Cheryl in Organizational Effectiveness and Human Resources, and I'm here for the same reason.
I'm Kimberly Knowledge. I'm working in the clinical epidemiology research and training. I'm interested in this topic because most students from different backgrounds can help.
I'm Bill Cruikshank. I'm an faculty member at the Pulmonary Center, although I do more association with the graduate departments, graduate students, and I'm very interested in helping to build the more culture of diversity in the graduate student program.
My name is Lindsay. I'm a dual master's in social work, master's in public health student in my second year, and I'm really interested in social justice and start the Adjunct Student Committee here.
I'm Sam Lowe. I'm a staff chaplain here at Boston Medical Center, and I'm mainly on the East Hinton campus.
I'm Marjorie Charlot. I'm a member of the Faculty Development and Diversity Committee, and I was full faculty in July in the medical oncology department.
My name is Justin McCummings. I'm the manager of the minority physician recruitment program at Boston Medical Center. And I just want to have an opportunity to meet colleagues that have definitely interest in this subject.
Cindy Gordon, Boston Medical Center, Clinical Director for Psychiatric Emergency Services, as well as the Bell Behavioral Health Department. It is a topic that is of interest to me.
Ken Danner, the Clinical Director of Hematology and Oncology. Topic that's of interest to us because we do have a very different population, and they also have very serious life-threatening diseases that become a complex issue.
I'm Laura Fagan. I'm with the Section of Infectious Diseases, and I was interested in the same thing that Ken just mentioned, but also intrigued with the concept of unconscious bias that might affect by working with students and residents and with our patients.
I'm Linda Zimmerman. I'm the manager of outreach for the Division of Graduate Medical Sciences. I run a summer undergraduate research program for students who are underrepresented minority students in the basic sciences. I'm just here to learn more.
My name is Yolanta Cavalco. I'm the administrative manager of the Office of Postdoctoral Affairs. We have about 500 postdocs, 65 or 70% of them are international postdocs. So I'm here to learn more how I can help them.
My name is Karen Sloan. I do pulmonary critical care. I recently took on a role as director of clinical quality for the Department of Medicine, so I'm interested in how we can form interdisciplinary teams to work together to improve quality of the care we provide.
My name is Doug Hughes, and I'm the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs for the medical school, and diversity is a real passion for our office. We support it in the students and the faculty.
And I already introduced myself, but for those that came late, I'm Rafael Ortega, the Associate Dean for Diversity and Multicultural Affairs.
Right, and I think we're two people who came in, didn't get a chance to introduce yourselves.
Okay, I'm Cole, and I'm a neurologist member of the hospital. Always want to come to
Oh, good. Glad to have you.
My name is Zahava. I'm the Center Coordinator for the Prevention Research Center at the School of Public Health.
So it sounds like we have a mix of people interested in reaching out to diverse patient populations as well as creating inclusive and smooth functioning teams among people from different backgrounds. So give you a little bit of context about the environment that we're working in. And the point of these slides is to show you that we do not necessarily reflect the range of experiences that our patients or our postdocs or our lab mates or coworkers have. This is female faculty in medical schools over time. And what do you notice about the trends?
Green is increasing.
Pardon me?
The green is increasing.
Right. So green is other or unknown. But the other colors, the Asian population, black faculty, Hispanic, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, fairly constant. And then this is the same for male faculty. You see, I think the green is growing there, but fairly stable over the past 10 years in terms of diversity. And some people refer to this as the pipeline problem, but there just aren't enough representatives from these different groups who are going to college, to medical school, to the professional programs that would allow them to become faculty. That's becoming less and less the case as we diversify the student population. And hopefully our medical school and others are working to make sure that our faculty represent the full range of students and trainees. This gives you a breakdown of BU in specific as we relate to our Massachusetts neighbors. So the blue lines are Harvard, which because of their size skews the scale, but BU is in red, and you can see that majority of our faculty are in the self-identify as white, a small bit of Asian, small bit of unknown, and black, Native American, Hawaiian, very low numbers. But this is true of our peers as well. And then I've broken it down by chairs. So this is all faculty. But then when we look at just chairs of departments, what do you notice about that trend?
There's a couple black, extra white.
Yeah, it looks like at Tufts, they have maybe a couple. The rest are white.
No, Asian.
Uh-huh, yeah, BU, Asian. And then one more, this is the chaired by sex, male and one in the far left, females in the middle. So how do we account for this? Why would the chairs be overwhelmingly male and white when we see the faculty as a much broader representation? Any thoughts come to mind of what would account for this narrowing of diversity at the top levels?
Linda? They're not getting the mentoring, they're not getting the opportunity to move up. Underrepresented. So not getting those opportunities. Not hearing about them or not getting the skills that are needed to work into those positions.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, before we even move to that plane of the discussion, and this is for this, I know that many of you are very aware of this, but for the sake of those that are relatively new to this concept, there's a social justice element, you know, that if 25% of the population is Hispanic, for example, 25% of the physicians should be Hispanic to have that kind of equity. Well, there's another reason, which in my view is probably more important, which is that since we are in the business of providing healthcare to those individuals, unless those that provide their healthcare are of the same ethnicity and unless they understand the culture, and in the case of Hispanics, oftentimes the language, the result of the physician-patient relationship will not be as fruitful as, you know, as otherwise. And our main goal is really to have a healthy population. So, yes, it's nice to be fair, but it's also nice to have a healthy country. And that's why it's important to have representation in the healthcare workforce, which is adjusted to the population.
Right, and that's the point. We're not saying that any of these chairs are bad chairs. Perhaps they are the most qualified and the most effective. But we are saying that everyone, as Linda was saying, everyone should have the opportunity to reach these positions. And maybe another way of looking at it is this is a graph of all the male CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Over 60% of them are 6 feet tall or above. But if you look at all males in the general US population, you know, about 15% are over 6 feet tall. I'm just about 6 feet, so I don't know where I would fall. I stand up tall. Would anyone argue that men over 6 feet tall make better CEOs? Is there anything intrinsic about being tall that makes you good at managing an organization?
I think taller is perceived as being stronger and more powerful, and you know, the individual who's tall may not be smarter and better, but there's that perception that the person is.
It's like politicians. Look at our two senators. They're both very tall white men.
Yeah.
I also think, did you ever read Gladwell's book?
This is from Malcolm Gladwell.
Oh, because, I mean, when you're a little child and you're physically bigger and able to do stuff, you're looked at older, you get more privileges, you get more advancement. And so it may be not having not anything to do with bias as adults. It may have everything to do with very early childhood and self-confidence and development and opportunities.
And that it accumulates.
And it just accumulates over time.
Right, and so there is no affirmative action program for short people. And just like there, no one is overtly giving favor to tall people when it comes to admissions or other sorts of advantages, but as Jane is saying, and Linda, there are certain cultural perceptions that equates tall or in athletic senses if they're bigger with success, and so they get more coaching, they get more opportunities, and they're on that path. So no one has signaled them out to say, you're going to go on the leadership track. That's this accumulation of small affirmations all along the way that streamlines them into that path. And by contrast, reduces opportunity for other people.
That concept cannot be underestimated at all. If I can translate it to ethnicity, I believe that to a large extent, that's why blacks from the islands and blacks from Africa may do better in high school and in college and in a higher education because they were brought up in an environment where they were constantly valued and reinforced, and where they saw role models that were like them, as opposed to a higher proportion of African Americans. So I attribute my health as a Hispanic in the United States to the fact that my ego was healthy as I was growing up where I grew up. But if you are short and you don't have those reinforcements and this and that, equally, you know, using the racial analogy, you may not fare as well as if you are tall.
So this is, it's called unconscious because no one is doing it on purpose. These are some quotes from minority faculty at UCSF where they did a survey. And you can see what some of them point out is that there's this, translated into a medical context, there's a narrowing of opportunity. As one person says, there's a paradigm person, that there's a certain type who gets rewarded at that institution. And another person says, there's an old boys network. So no one is putting me down or overtly discriminating, but I'm just not included. Decisions are being made at the club, at the bar, at the golf course, areas where this person is not privy to. Is this resonating? Do you see where this might happen in our institution or in your particular units? Or anyone do admissions for medical school residency, fellowship, programs like that? How do you counter some of these biases, this sort of paradigm person you always have in your mind? There's the ideal applicant who's going to meet all these criteria. How do you open up your mind to take into account that there may be other ways of being a successful applicant?
I think one of the ways is you try not to have a picture of the person in your mind. So when you're interviewing or looking at applicants, you want to try and be as objective as possible, look at specific criteria in terms of numbers and grades, and then also obviously personality through the personal statement and then letters of recommendation without necessarily looking at picture, looking at name, and looking at those things first, maybe saving those to look at last, if at all.
There have been some studies on names.
Yes.
There were economists, you might have seen this, who sent out resumes, identical resumes, but then put stereotypically white names, as the census goes, the names most commonly associated with whites and names most commonly associated with African Americans. Resumes were identical and then measured how many callbacks did each one get. As you can, well, I don't know if you can imagine, but the results were that the stereotypically black names received fewer callbacks. Even when the ad said minorities encouraged to apply, equal opportunity employer, had no impact on the people they actually called back, but the CVs were identical. So as Anna points out, maybe sort of blinding the name or sometimes the institution could be a trigger for associations that have nothing to do with the applicant, but have other connotations in your mind. This is a link to an online test which you can take. There are a number of tests. We have unconscious biases about weight, about age, about religion, about sexual orientation. I don't know if they can do height, but I think they have presidential candidates for a Republican. So you can pick your bias. And often, all it takes is an awareness that we have bias to start neutralizing those assumptions that come in. It's free. It's only about 15 minutes. So if you are on a search committee or any sort of selection process, it helps to have everyone take this. And it really doesn't matter which of the quizzes they check, but it helps alert them that these are things that might be in my mind that I'm not aware of. And just having that consciousness can help neutralize some of the biases. One more concept, then we'll get to some exercises. Oh, this is an example of how unconscious bias worked in orchestras. So up until 1980, these were considered the top five orchestras in the country. Most of them were overwhelmingly male. What happened in 1980 to see the increase in women players? They started holding auditions behind a screen. And all you could hear was the musicality. You couldn't see the person. You couldn't see the name. At least for the initial audition, all you heard was how that person played. And all the unconscious bias before of women aren't good brass players, trumpet players. Women aren't good with the fine skills that it takes for a violin. All whatever your assumptions were, all that were canceled out because you just heard the music before you made
opinion. The interesting thing about that unconscious bias issue is that that doesn't necessarily mean that it was just the men that were undervaluing the work of the women. Women also are known to undervalue the work of women. And somewhere along the way I read that how did the women walk behind the curtain to play the cello? How did they walk? Barefoot. Because even the sound of the shoes could give you a hint that it was the weaker sex. So anyway.
Well, that's the thing. So the next point is what's called stereotype threat. And this is when you're saying when members of minority groups, and we're defining, in some cases, you know, women minority group in the orchestra setting. In this case, this is male and female high school chemistry students. Minority students tend to internalize some of these unconscious biases, and it negatively affects their performance. So a lot of examples of this. I just took one that was sort of science-related. The researchers asked, these are sort of juniors and seniors in high school in chemistry, to read a passage, a chemical principle, and then to answer a comprehension test. But the variable was, in some of the lessons, the pictures were of male scientists, and then that's what they call stereotypic. So you see, when female and male students read that example, female students tended to do worse on the comprehension test. The middle two bars are where the illustrations were female scientists. And all of a sudden, your same group of students, the female, or the same class of students, that group, female students did better than male. And in the last, the images were mixed, male and female scientists. And all of a sudden, the results were relatively even. So there's no intrinsic disability in women to perform well in science. They had to be primed. And sometimes it's as easy as saying before an exam, these results have been shown to have no difference based on sex or based on ethnicity. And with that, the sort of confidence kicks in and performances are equaled out. So to think of a way we can translate that to this setting, I thought of this image. How is this a stereotype threat? And what can we do to counteract it?
What you did.
Right. So I think very cleverly, on the opposite wall, which I don't have a photo of because we've seen just walking just around the corner, are the living legends. And even just further down the hall, an exhibit that Raphael's office put up of African-American surgeons. But I saw someone last week just scrutinizing that and was so happy to see that it's not just this backdrop.
Right. But, not devoid of controversy. For example, some people have come to me to complain that the African-American surgeons that were selected may not be necessarily deserving of being in the exhibit, and that some that should be there were not there.
Ah.
So it's a very fine line to walk. and I can't help but to think of the birth control pill, because the reason why it's men, you needed a revolution. You needed to be able to empower women through a lot of, right to vote, right to control your own body and things like that. So it's not surprising to me that there were men.
Who were advancing in their careers
exactly,
at that point.
Yes.
Right? So a way we can, stereotype threat doesn't occur just in images, it's also in words. And I've put up here, these are some things that I've heard, not just at this institution, but in other work settings, phrases or sentences that send some of those signals that tell minorities that you're not included or you're not expected to perform as well and could offend or trigger some sort of negative behavior. So I wonder if we could work as a group and remedy this. So this is something that you see in job descriptions sometimes. You're Boston University looking for a distinguished senior scientist to serve as director of some institute. How could we rephrase that that might send a more inclusive message?
Or accomplished?
Mm-hmm.
Accomplished scientist?
Yeah.
Or something specific, you know, stating one awards or giving real criteria.
How about a risk taker? This has been seen to discriminate sometimes against women or minority scientists who, or actually to favor the macho type who is willing to take, you know, change paradigms. Is there another way of saying risk taker that's not as exclusive?
Maybe creative thinker? Innovative?
Yeah, there's not going to be any slides on the right. There's no right answers. So how we could generate it together. Did you have a...
Oh, innovate, like, less...
Stereotypical, right. Chairman? I've heard this one. You mean Tony, the male nurse. You implanted that?
Yeah.
And how did you address that with your group?
It's just nurse. Nurse. I'm not making it so.
Someone actually said that class that he's been referred to as the male nurse.
And I've heard lady physician too.
Yeah.
But there's your physician itself does not imply a sex. The faculty wives club. Again, not all faculty are male. Mm-hmm, right, and not all are married. This is when I actually got this. There was a, the chairman of general pediatrics at Children's just wrote, you went to see this, Doug? He wrote a piece about being gay in medical school. And he was trained at Harvard, I think in the 70s, 80s. And he was a star student. And he was asked to sit on this committee, and he had read this application and thought, this person is amazing. You know, tens all across the board. Gets to the committee meeting, and the faculty member on the panel had rated this person twos, completely out of sync with everyone else. And they asked the faculty member, why did this person get such low scores after the interview and everything? And the faculty member said, I just didn't feel comfortable with the applicant. And he said the applicant was an effeminate man, but was completely qualified for the position. But this was the code that was used to say, he wouldn't do well here. He's not our kind. So how could you phrase this differently? Or how would you deal with that in a committee meeting if someone used that phrase?
I'd just exit out. Say, what do you mean? I don't think there's a way to read. Make a subjective opinion of somebody which is inappropriate.
So I've seen this, unfortunately, I've been involved in it. So I just said, like, how, in what way would that play out? You know, what specifically, are there specific piece you're uncomfortable, and how would that play out in a way that makes the person ineffective at the job? And sort of really play it out in that way, not necessarily confronting, saying, you know, you're a racist bigot. But, you know, sort of trying to play out and say, you know, I sometimes do this with my extended family, where people will say things like, and it's like, okay, well, how does that make a difference? How does that play out? What specific ways will that person, you know, not be effective?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's very interesting. I mean, this whole thing in the Republican about the international advisor to Romney, who was basically forced out of his position because the right wing, and it's very, you know, it's very, very interesting how to deal with this.
And maybe it goes back to what Anna was saying about setting up criteria ahead of time. Before you get to this point, you have a sort of structured list of these are the things we're looking for, so that when a comment like this comes up, you can say, well, which box does that fit into? Is it the experience? Is it the teamwork? Is it the... And then you sort of cancel out that comment.
But a lot of times when you're doing things like interviews, you know, if you've done a lot of those critique work ahead of time, and so sometimes the rating sessions can get into a lot of subjective things. So I just try to think about how to, you know, eliminate that for me, because a lot of times really the interview process is really all the boxes are checked off for all these people that are coming in.
But language is also very fluid, so just as you can sort of control for that, then it moves on to, like, you know, keeping women out of the workforce. You can use words like Planned Parenthood, we don't support Planned Parenthood, or, you know, like, you can see in different ways that just as you control for certain code words, the language changes into other sort of new code words that sort of are used to block a particular group's advancement.
And they've done analyses of letters of recommendation in medical settings and other academic settings. And so this is both when you're reading and when you're writing letters of recommendation, that for female applicants, they tend to use plodding adjectives, they call them. You know, she's she chugs along, she goes, she's tireless. But for the men, they're very active. You know, he is dynamic, he's pursuing exciting new work. And you know, both are qualities, but one comes across differently than the other.
Is that from both women and men?
Recommenders? I believe so. But they control for that. It doesn't make much of a difference. So we can be aware as we write and as we read and have multiple people do the reading and the interviewing. This is one I heard actually on this campus recently. A visiting professor was giving a sort of keynote talk over in Kiefer, and the person who introduced her said she's a role model for women.
Role model, period.
A lot of these phrases, if you take them out of context, you know, can be misinterpreted, because I can see you being a good role model for our female medical students. I can definitely see that. Why? Because of a lot of experiences that you might have had that I haven't had as a man. So it depends. Some of these things depend, and you can certainly be a physician and a lady. A lady physician has a different connotation.
But maybe it's what you were saying, you'd be specific to say she's a role model for medical students who have families.
Yeah.
Or who are juggling certain...
Peter, if I can bring the conversation more to the... because the gist of this is how to make the work environment, right, more inclusive and welcoming. And it's not just for us, because our patients come to our work environment, so they also need to feel comfortable, and as well as we need to feel comfortable. And I have to mention this because it's the best example that I have in the last 12 months of dealing with diversity issues, which was the Human Rights Campaign survey of hospitals. We in Massachusetts came at the very bottom because, you know, the Human Rights Campaign is the largest gay and lesbian organization in the country, and they conduct a health equality index survey in which they measure how explicit the language is in healthcare institutions to make them welcoming for LGBTs. And even though we consider ourselves at Boston Medical Center fairly open compared to Bay State and the BI and everybody else, we were at the very bottom because we did not use explicit language in our policies, procedures, mission statements regarding, you know, the visitation rights, end of life decisions, equal opportunity, and all that. And that was a quick fix. But if you read, for example, the Joint Commission's latest recommendations on how to make healthcare institutions welcoming, in particular for LGBT, all kinds of suggestions there. They have a list of about 30 points, including how you designate your bathrooms, you know, male or female, because you have a lot of transgender issues. And just this weekend, I went to the Starbucks in the corner of Beacon and Charles Street, you know, right in front of the park. And I know that they did it for space reasons, but it felt kind of comforting for me that the bathroom was handicapped, you know, male and female. There's one bathroom which should be kept clean. You see, but the Joint Commission points that out. They point out how in the H&P form, you know, you're forced to decide, you know, gender. And you have some patients that, you know, or sexual orientation, which is not included. So you start sending these subtle cues about the workplace, and subconsciously and consciously you start feeling more or less comfortable. I can't pass the opportunity to bring up the rainbow flag in the Office of Diversity, which recently has stirred a little bit of controversy among the students. And to give you a little bit of a historical background, and maybe we can open it up for discussion because I'm interested in feedback, because the office traditionally dealt with minority issues in the strict sense, you know, of race and ethnicity. The office had a lot of memorabilia and a lot of symbols of Hispanics and African Americans at the exclusion of other groups, the Muslims, the Jews, the gays, etc. So one of the things that I did was to kind of dismantle that, but not to the point that people would flip out because their symbols were totally gone, but to replace them with meaningful activities, such as an award for being the best marching group during the gay pride parade, such as an announcement of a lecture such like this in our bulletin board, such as photographs of other activities. You see what I mean? So it generated a little bit of tension because some people want to make the office more welcoming, which is the purpose of, you know, the purpose of this talk today. But in doing so, one has to be very careful because it might be at the perceived exclusion of others, you know. So I like to ask you folks what sort of symbols and what sort of overt announcements can take place in the context of the medical campus to make both patients and co-workers feel more valued, more included, more accepted in the context of the, you know, of the tapestry which we should strive to be. So what do you think, Dr. Hughes?
I don't know if it's necessarily a symbol per se, but I think it shows by, like what you said, like who the faculty are, who the chair are. I think a lot of the diversity issues, particularly at BU, that can't speak for other institutions, is just that there are systematic issues that need to be changed, and it's difficult to do that through the use of symbols. But I mean, maybe that's a start, but I think that it takes more than just a symbol to sort of overcome those barriers.
I think I agree. I think for some groups, I mean, women, for the most part, you can identify visually. Some ethnic groups you can identify visually. But there are groups that you look at and they're not so obvious visually. You know, if you're a Baptist or you know, an Episcopalian, you don't know that unless you have a symbol of your religion. You know, you wear a cross or you wear a Star of David or something that tells you you belong to this religion, because it's not as obvious. And I think for LGBT, where it's not as obvious, oftentimes the symbols become maybe more important, because otherwise they fear being invisible. Mm-hmm. And so I think symbols in some groups are probably more important than in other groups, because they're trying to find an identity and they're trying to feel a part of a group. And without that part of the symbol, they can feel that they're not included.
Standard point.
I have maybe we do a few role plays that will bring out some of how we operationalize this, because when we can move through these, because there's language, there's symbols that you can put up ahead of time, but then often we're making these decisions in the moment. You hear something, you think of something, you see someone who's feeling excluded. How do you react to that? Let's can move past these to the role play so we get a chance to do that. So here are, oops, that went back. So I'll read this and we can answer this as a group. So after returning from maternity leave, a female member of your group, of your faculty, of your clinic, or whatever your unit is, wants to come back at partial time. Meaning not coming in on Fridays, but that's when your group has its standing meeting on Fridays. How do you make it inclusive for that person?
Conference call?
Yep.
You so use technology to get around that?
And why Friday? Is there something holy about Friday that it has to be on that day? Can you change the day of the meeting?
Yeah.
Why do you make it sound so easy?
Yeah.
So it sounds like...
It seems like making those changes would be more effective than saying, oh, we'll just catch you up on Monday. Because I would imagine that we'll just catch you up on Monday might be something that wouldn't be an inclusive effort, even though maybe someone thought it would be, you know? So I think that the things that were suggested would be more effective then.
Right, because she or he could never participate if he was just catching up on Monday.
Catch up on everything. They're going to be a step behind because things were said that couldn't be relayed.
Yeah, or given feedback. So.
I mean, the other thing is also whoever the colleague is, or, you know, obviously it's a female in this case, is before she comes back from maternity leave, or when she can say, you know, how... what makes the best schedule for you so that you can be continue to be effective at work. We have a mandatory meeting in our thing on Fridays, and so I rearranged the schedule of a nurse practitioner who could never make it, felt left out, and said, well, why, let's change your day off from Friday to a different day, and so that was another way. Not, I mean, yes, you could change the lab meeting, that would be great if possible, but also to talk about what, you know, what she wants to, you know.
Maybe take notice, you know, because sometimes it's hard when you're the person who's missing. You may not be the one who feels empowered to say, oh, I actually miss this meeting every week. So then make sure we as a department are taking notice of who's there, who's not there, and maybe reaching out to people versus waiting for them to come and say, oh, I'm missing whatever.
So the next one asks about, you have, in your model, you mentioned a lot of international students and postdocs. So let's say I just chose China because this is an example I've heard from a PI of a lab. So three members of your group are from China. They talk to each other, but when it comes to the group, they're not as engaged. How do you draw them out? How do you do so? How do you make them feel more a part of the group if they seem introverted when you're all together?
We're dealing with that problem right now, and they listen to each other more than they listen to PI or advisors or anybody else. And what they say to each other is more, it's very important to them. You know, they support each other. But they should be listening to their PIs or mentors, because what they're hearing from each other is not what they need to be, you know, hearing. And it's very hard. It's very hard.
I just ask them, just say that we'd like you to get more involved, and how should we go about doing that so that you're more comfortable talking to the group? I mean, give us some ideas of what we should do. Just ask them directly.
And these are open-ended, involve them in solving.
It may be that they're not comfortable talking in English in front of a group, or even just talking in a group situation. So maybe if you solicit input before a meeting and read out what they have written for input at the meeting, that might be a way to sort of draw them out a little bit. And once they're engaged a little, they might begin to speak. You know, you can ask an open-ended question of everybody before the meeting and ask them to just submit their answers.
Right. This came from, you reminded me, we have a colleague, Isabel Dominguez, who's a researcher in hematology oncology, and she had some people in her group who were very shy. So she did just that. She said at the beginning of the meeting, everyone gets to say something. Tell us about a neat science article you read in the New York Times this week. Something very low stakes, just to get everyone participating. And then moved into the meat of the lab meeting.
Yeah, that's another thing. I had a colleague who was very, very shy, would always look at your shoes, you know, never look you in the eye. But he had a dog. And if you talked about his dog, he would talk to you. So I just started with that.
Can I interject for a moment, Peter? At least from the feedback that I have received from these meetings that we have titled conversations, and we've done them about, you know, being black at BUMC and being gay and being Hispanic and being Muslim and being a Jew and all that, I think that, like I said, from the feedback that I have received from the participants, is that by virtue of people knowing that these activities take place, and by them becoming aware that individuals of their same cultural or ethnic group have those successes or barriers, you can create a more inclusive, and you can develop an environment where people feel more comfortable. If not so much for the content of the activity, just because the activity itself took place. So if you ask me that, you know, how three researchers from China, la la, I would invite them to the next conversation, which is about Asians as opposed to South Asians. And the only reason why we don't have them all in one sitting is because there are just too many cultural groups. And I am forced to sort of breaking them apart. Even in the case of the Asians, I had to make, or we, with my, I'm sorry?
East Asian.
No, you could take it to that level as well. But at least in the medical center, because you have so many Asians and so many South Asians, Pakistanis, Indians, Bangladeshis, I thought that the distinction was more pragmatic, mm-hmm. you know?
And this goes to your earlier point about diversity within minority groups, talking about Hispanic, all the different fault lines, that not to assume.
Right,
that,
because for all I know, these three researchers from China may be very different in the context of their own culture. So it's complicated.
Right. Jane?
I mean, I think one of the other things is that not just that they should be listening, but we should be listening to them. It's like teenagers. I mean, you know, they're like foreigners in your own home. And so sort of, you know, again, out and maybe one-on-one, the PI should take each of them separately for lunch at some point and just say, let me get to know you, what's important to you, or at the lab meetings, you know, something personal and important so you can understand what they're, and they may have different fears about things going, you know, whatever, who knows. And so.
I think that in certain cultures, they will not speak unless they ask to speak, you know, Japanese, for example. So you have to learn the culture as a PI or as a mentor.
Or as a physician.
As a physician.
So two key words come to mind right there. It's one of cultural literacy, and the other one is of self-awareness. You have to be aware of what you're bringing to the table and how this person might react towards me because I'm a male or a Hispanic or what have you. But I also should know a bit of where he's coming from. For my practice in the operating room and in the acute care setting, that goes a long way, I feel.
Yeah, there was just a study published in the American Journal of Public Health where they gave physicians that implicit bias test, the link I put up there, and they found those with the greatest bias, though then they observed them in the clinic with their patients, and those with the greatest bias had the most, what they call, condescending language to patients, or talking down, versus, and then those patients rated their care worse. But physicians who have least amount of bias, they found that they were more included in their care, and they rated their satisfaction higher. So it does have direct implications.
Yeah, but if I remember correctly, because let's call it like it is, it was more from the white folks towards the black folks, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So the another scenario, we have just a few minutes that I'd like you to do an evaluation, get feedback from you. Then this could be a patient, or a coworker, a lab mate, whatever your setting is. You notice this person is wearing a wedding ring. You didn't know this person, you don't know anything about, I think I said about his personal life. What do you say anything? What do you say? How do you approach this?
I think it depends on your relationship with the person, right?
Yeah.
And so, congratulations is always appreciated.
Yeah. And so you keep it vague, you don't probe further?
I think it depends again on your relationship with the person, about how much you want to delve in and how much they want you to delve in.
To be cautious, try to get signals from that person.
You could just mention the fact. You could say, you know, I see you have a new ring. Is that significant?
Yeah, I would be really careful because I think if they're very private, it could be something they don't really want to talk about.
Yeah.
If they haven't told you, then, you know, the reason for that, I guess I usually care on the side of caution, meeting the person,
think,
you know, from students you've had before, social
cues
you've had before,
that
maybe they don't.
Like
yeah.
This is that awareness.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we didn't have time there. I can send it on the slides, but I also have up here, I mean, the sort of, you hear an offensive comment or joke. And these are is a different scenario. It's a more hostile environment. So we have some suggestions. There's one called name it, claim it, stop it. So be very specific. That joke you told made me feel uncomfortable, and I'd appreciate it if you don't make light of those topics or is having an adverse effect on our ability to work as a team. So this is sort of good advice for any sort of feedback for learners, for coworkers, but to be specific, be timely, and to use these what they call I statements, talk about how it made you feel. You're not here to blame anyone, you're here to educate and not make assumptions. Any final thoughts about how you could, anything you heard today that you think you can carry forward into your work settings?
Peter, thank you, and Raphael, this is wonderful that you guys are doing these things, both in the evening and today. It's wonderful.
With food, right?
With food. That makes it more wonderful. Cookies.
Thank you.
Anything else that you want to close, or any statement that might carry forward?
No, I just want to thank everyone for coming, and you know, I want to use the opportunity to remind everyone that this is a work in progress. This is never ending, and as the demographics of the country change, so are we forced to change. Like I said at the beginning, if we were a very homogeneous society, we wouldn't be talking about this, but we're not. And in fact, we're getting more diverse as time goes on, and it behooves each one of us in the interest of the country itself, in the well-being and the strength of the country, to address this issue so that we can all contribute with our differences to make a greater place. Thank you very much.
Thank you.